Once upon a time, the whole country was in big trouble. Okay, this really happened, but there are a lot of details that would take a lot of time for me to set up. Like, the king's name in this country is Joram, and the capital city where they're all hiding out is Samaria. The attacking army is from up north in Aram, called Arameans. They speak Aramaic. The name of the Aram's king is Ben-Hadad. Ben means son of, so his dad was the king Hadad. And growing up, when his dad came home from the palace, the little guy probably yelled when he saw his dad, "Hey, Dad!" Ben-Hadad has attacked Samaria before because Samaria is in a really sweet piece of property, you know, location, location, location. So Samaria is right in the middle of all the trade routes in the whole world. You can make a lot of money just by setting up toll booths if you own Samaria. So Hadad Jr. has now surrounded the capital city of Samaria. He has said, "We are staying here until you come out and surrender or until we come in and kill you." And King Joram on the inside said, "Not by the hair of our chinny chin chins." But now the people are on the verge of starving. They've been in there so long because the Wegmans in Samaria isn't getting any new deliveries, and the Burger King and KFC and Otto Tomatoes in Samaria have all closed, and people in Samaria have eaten all the Campbell's new chicken noodle soup and Dinty Moore's beef stew that they have in their cupboards. And donkey heads, the eating of which is against their religion, donkey heads are now commanding top dollar on the black market. In fact, it's so bad that King Joram gets approached by a lady who got cheated by a friend in a Donner Party kind of way that I can't even repeat while some of you are still eating breakfast. If you want, you can read about it. It's in your Bible in 2 Kings 6, but take my word for it, whether the kids were dead or alive, it is an ugly story. See, there are a lot of things happening here in this section of scripture, and it's already cost me half a page to explain why it's going to take too long to explain all this to you. Which is why I went with once upon a time, the whole country was in big trouble. Because I know once upon a time means it's a make-believe story, but when you hear once upon a time, you assume that there's a lot of stuff that's already happened that you don't know about, and that's true in this story. But the big difference here is this story is for real. This one really happened. And it's one of my favorite Old Testament events because of how it challenges me at the end of the story. So here we go. Once upon a time, the whole country was in big trouble. They could not imagine, much less remember, ever being in this much trouble. They really thought that life as they knew it might be over that day. At which point, Elisha shows up. Elisha back then is the most famous televangelist. Elisha has famously done several cool things with God's help. He has exposed assassination attempts. He has produced water for the whole army in the middle of the desert when there was no water. He raised a boy back to life. Elisha is well known for being well connected to God. So Elisha comes and he tells the king, "Hey, tomorrow Samaria's Taco Bell is going to have a deal on nachos, and the Cheesecake Factory is going to be practically giving away Bang Bang Chicken and Shrimp," which was really good news in that none of them had eaten anything for a long time. And when Elisha said something was going to happen because God told him, it always happened. But one guy there didn't buy it. He didn't think even God could do that. In 2 Kings 7:1, it says, "Elisha replied, 'Hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Lord says. About this time tomorrow, a seah of finest flour will sell for a shekel, and two seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria.'" Verse 2 says, "The officer on whose arm the king was leaning said to the man of God, 'Look, even if the Lord should open the floodgates of the heavens, could that happen?' Elisha answered, 'You will see it with your own eyes, but you won't eat any of it.'" Spoiler alert, there is tons of food in Samaria the next day, and this guy gets none of it because he was so absolutely sure that what God promised wasn't going to happen. Do you ever find yourself in that situation? You know what God promises, but you absolutely know that that's not going to happen. Like when God says, "If you ask me for stuff, I can give it to you," but you know you'll never get that, so you don't even bother to ask. Or like when God says, "Forgive those who did you harm, pray for those who go after you," but you know that they're not worth fixing, so you just keep spitting at them in your head. Or like when God says, "If you will put me first, if you will live with my kingdom as your number one thing in life, I will take care of everything that you need." And yet you still put your job before everything and everyone in your life. Or like when God says, "Repent and be baptized, follow my son, and I will always be with you." And you think, I'm just going to try to make do the best I can on my own. Elisha says, "God is going to make food aplenty available tomorrow." And this guy said, "I doubt it." And in the end, when everybody's eating the next day, it does not go well for him, just saying. On to the really good part of the story. That night, there are four lepers sitting outside the city gates, thinking about how bad it is to be them. One of the lepers said, "I had such a happy childhood. I remember when I was little, my dad used to roll me downhill in tires. Oh, those were good years." No, that's not what they were saying. They were saying, "Okay, we're quarantined because we have a contagious disease, but we're starving to death. If we go into the city to find food, they're going to kill us, and there's no food in there anyway. If we go over where the Aramean army is, they're going to kill us because we're the enemy. If we just sit here, we're going to die of hunger." Decisions, decisions, decisions. Finally, one of the lepers said, "But what if we went over there and they just took us prisoner? They would put us in jail and we would get bread and water." And another one said, "Oh, bread and water, that would be so good." And another one said, "But they'd probably just kill us." And the last guy said, "But at least then we wouldn't be hungry." And they said, "Right, let's try it." So they walked towards the enemy camp. Their hope is that they're going to be captured and put in jail. Do you know what they call a guy who gets tased in prison? Shaka Khan. They're walking gingerly, these guys. They have their hands up. They're hoping that they're going to prison. They're hoping they're not going to get shish kebabbed with arrows. They get to the edge of the camp, but nobody comes out. And they yell, "We give up. You win. We surrender." But they get no reply at all. So they walk in and they look around the camp for somebody to surrender to, but nobody's home. So they check the next tent and there's nobody there. And they think, well, maybe there's a big meeting somewhere in camp. But they look, no matter where they look, there isn't a single soldier to be found. Why not? Where did they all go? What's up with an empty army camp just sitting there? Well, do you remember when we just said that God, when he says something, it always comes true? So here's how 2 Kings 7 explains what happened. 2 Kings 7:5 says, "At dusk, the lepers got up and they went out to the camp of the Arameans. When they reached the edge of the camp, no one was there, for the Lord had caused the Arameans to hear sounds of chariots and horses and a great army. So they said to one another, 'Look, the king of Israel has hired the Hittite and the Egyptian kings to attack us.' So they got up and they fled in the dusk and they abandoned their tents and their horses and their donkeys and they left the camp as it was and ran for their lives." God arranged for the besieging army to think that they were being ambushed, and they fled the premises. So the four lepers found an army full of stuff just sitting there, including a mess tent with food on all the tables. It's kind of like the first time you ever went to Golden Corral, and you can't believe how much food is there. So you eat and you eat and you eat until you can't eat, then you eat some more. There's so much food. But then these guys realize there were no soldiers there. They had all left, and they probably left their wallets in the barracks. So they went and they grabbed all the money and all the silver and all the gold and all the Air Jordans and all the big screen TVs they could find in camp, and they went out and they stashed it all away. That was tiring work, so they came back in and they raided the dessert bar. Try to see it from their point of view. They thought they were going to die when they walked over here and said they won the lottery. And they're lepers. They haven't won anything for as long as any of them can remember. Leprosy has been called the devil's dirtiest trick. You don't die, you just don't really live. You're miserable. You lose your body and your family and your job and your community and your hope. These guys who have done nothing in their lives for a long time suddenly have what no one else has. Can you imagine? But what comes next is the key to why this story matters today. As they continue to eat and drink and bury more and more treasures in caves nearby, in verse 9, it says, "Then they said to each other, 'What we're doing is not right. This is a day of good news, and we're keeping it to ourselves. If we wait until daylight, punishment will overtake us. Let us go at once and report this to the royal palace.'" How about that? Right in the middle of their great fortune, they think of others. They think, oh, we should share what we've got with everybody else. They've been packing it away when all of a sudden they decide, whoa, we got to go tell people. They have discovered something wonderful, and they've decided they're going to let others in on it. So they head back to the city gates, where they get stopped because they're lepers, which was normal for them. But this time they said, oh, but we're very lucky lepers. We need to talk to the king. And the guard said, you stay right there. We'll tell the king, you stay where you are. But when the king hears the news, he can't believe it. He says, no, it must be a trap. They're waiting for us to come out, and then they're going to get us. It's a trap. The king here is kind of like the guy who said, I'm hoping somebody can help me with a cure for the hiccups, but I'm not holding my breath. The king thinks the good news is too good to be true. And can you see the lepers at this point? They're saying, no, king, no, 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 it's true. Look, we've got chocolate syrup stains all over our togas. Look, we've got Rolex watches on our arms. We drove Porsches back to the city. The army's gone. It's all ours. So the king says, well, we're all going to die here anyway. Let's send some people out and see what's going on. Scouts went and checked out the camp. They followed the trail of the fleeing army, finding armor and clothes and other stuff shed along the way. They came back and they said, we think they're really gone. We don't know why, but they left in a hurry. Verse 16 says, then the people of the city went out and plundered the camp of the Arameans. So a seah of the finest flour sold for a shekel, and two seahs of barley sold for a shekel, as the Lord had said. One day, all those people thought they were done. Life was over. The next day, those people were richer than they'd ever been before in their lives, ever, and it had just been handed to them. And these four lepers, who had been the least of the least up till then, were now the heroes. Because they didn't stop with just finding and enjoying good news for themselves, they passed it on. And that's the one point I really want us to get today. When God arranges for us to find something great, even in the midst of terrible, be sure to share it with other people. It's just the way God does things. When everything's the worst, he often brings something really good. Do you remember Joseph, who was sold to slavers by his brothers, and God lets him end up running Potiphar's estate before ruling the world? Do you remember Ruth's father-in-law dies, and brother-in-law dies, and husband dies, and she has to leave her home, and God lets her meet and marry a wealthy and wonderful guy who fell in love with her? Do you remember Elizabeth, who is very old and has never had children? And then God allowed her to give birth to the prequel of the Messiah. Do you remember Paul got stuck in a Roman jail for 2 years, chained to a rotating set of guards? Every 6 hours, the guards would change there. And they think they're keeping Paul locked in, but he's thinking, oh, God is locking these people right next to me. I get to talk to them for 6 more hours. Plus, Paul had some downtime in which he could write a lot of the Bible. Do you remember when Jesus was being tortured to death by the people he came to save? Peter has denied him. His disciples have left him. God doesn't seem to be there. It feels like Jesus has completely failed, like the evil ones won. And at that point, the guy, one cross over, says, I still think you're going to win. Can I be on your team? And even in that worst moment ever, God arranges for Jesus to find a treasure. It's just so important that we learn to look for the good amidst the not. Do you know Hidden Pictures? That page in the Highlights magazine that used to spot and circle birds and hats and faces that were hidden somewhere in there? It's so important that we learn to look for the unexpected good that God is hiding behind all the bad. It's always there somewhere. There is beauty in the ashes. There is something to thank him for, something that can be turned towards the good of others if we'll just see it, if we'll look for it. There's always a treasure nearby, but you got to look. COVID-19 is a vile thing, a virus that preys on the elderly, the compromised, the vulnerable. It causes painful death. People are afraid. Precautions are costing many their jobs. Unemployment is causing stress, which leads to anger and striking out, broken relationships. I don't think the evil one takes delight in anything. I don't think he has delight inside of him. But I'm pretty sure he's okay with all the chaos that this virus has caused. COVID-19 is vile. But in the middle of the bad, there is good to be found. Families who are spending more time with each other than they ever have before. We are connecting with friends that we normally wouldn't have talked to or had the chance. We're evaluating how much of our lives we give to our jobs and to other things that matter. We're considering our own mortality. I mean, COVID is so bad, it's even got the government of our country shutting down churches, right? But then again, You're watching this assembly in your home. Sarah used to tell me that we should live stream our Sunday assemblies, but I said no, I didn't really want to go out into space and back again every Sunday morning. But now we've had to, and we find out it's a really good thing. All I'm saying is that if you look, you can see rays of light that God sends into the darkness. Like, how about the fact that COVID requires hospital patients to have no visitors while they're there? That's a bad thing, right? Because part of getting through hospital stuff is having people that you love with you. So when our friend had brain surgery recently, and she had to recover alone in her room, and she can't see very much because that's part of the problem that she had. We're hoping that comes back. But she can't read, and her husband couldn't be with her there, and she can't read all the encouraging words that are being sent to her on Facebook. So the nurses ended up reading what people wrote to her. And some of the nurses don't have a relationship with Jesus, but they sure have heard a lot about him now. I'm not saying bad stuff is good. I'm saying God is so big he can twist bad into good. And part of doing life right is to know that, to expect that, to look for that in your life. If you will look for good in the middle of your bad, you will find chances to help other people see God better. And there's nothing in the world we can do more important than to help other people see him like he really is. Look for the opportunities that he's giving you. I went to play pickleball this week at Craig Park with my son. There was only one court open when I got there, so I'm waiting there for Jess, and a guy I know in the car next to me gets out and says, "Hey, John, are you here to play today?" And I said, "Yeah, my son's coming. We're going to play." He goes, "Well, I got a bunch of people coming too." And he grabbed all his stuff and he headed over to an empty court. And I thought, well, that's rude. But then I called Jess and I said, "Hey, we can't play here. Let's go play somewhere else today." So we ended up somewhere else. And we found a whole new crew of people playing there who graciously invited us to join in with them. And now Jess and I have 16 new friends whom we can first dazzle with our pickleball skills and then hopefully point them towards a better relationship with the one who loves them the most. Where is it in your life where you could do good? Your family and the way they see you do life in front of them every day, your coworkers who wrestle with hard stuff in life just like you do and they watch how you handle it, the people you work out with at the gym, your neighbors across the street, the people you do business with on a regular basis, a bunch of ICU nurses, a new set of pickleball players, a city full of hungry people. If you will be alert to those around you, even when life is really hard for you, you will see people who could really benefit from knowing Jesus like we do. A missionary named Milton Cunningham boarded a plane in Atlanta headed for Dallas. And as he sat down, he noticed a little girl next to him who had Down syndrome. And she looked at him when he sat down, and she kept looking at him as he settled into a seat, and she watched him as he buckled his lap strap. And then when he was all in his seat, she nudged him. And she said, "Mister, did you brush your teeth this morning?" And he smiled at the personal nature of the question, and he said, "Well, yes, I did." And she said, "Good, you're supposed to brush your teeth." And then she said, "Mister, do you smoke?" And he said, "No, I don't smoke." And she said, "Good, because smoking can kill you." And she waited a minute, and then she looked at him, and she said, "Mister, do you love Jesus?" And he said, as a missionary, that one was pretty easy. He said, "Yes, I do love Jesus." And she said, good, you ought to love Jesus." He said a few minutes later, another man came into the airplane and put his luggage in the overhead and sat down in the seat right across the aisle from him. And this little girl with Down syndrome watched that guy as he went through all of that. And then when he sat down, she nudged Milton Cunningham and she said, "Ask him." And he said, "Ask him what?" And she said, "Ask him if he brushed his teeth this morning." And he said, you don't ask people. She said, ask him. So finally, he turned and he said, "Excuse me, sir. My friend over here wants to know if you brushed your teeth this morning." And the guy looked around Milton and he saw the girl and he smiled and he said, "Well, yes, I brushed my teeth this morning." And she leaned forward past Milton. She looked at the other man. She said, "Good, you're supposed to brush your teeth." After a moment, the girl nudged Milton again and she said, "Ask him." And he said he knew where this was going to go, but he said, "Ask him what?" And she said, "Ask him if he smokes." So Milton turned to the man across the aisle and said, "Excuse me again, sir, but do you smoke?" And the guy smiled and said, "No, I do not smoke." And she leaned forward around Milton and said, "Good, because smoking can kill you." And then she leaned back and she looked at Milton and she said, "Ask him." And he said, "Ask him what?" And she said, "Ask him if he loves Jesus." And he said, "You don't ask people questions like that. That's too personal." She said, "Ask him, ask him, ask him." So he finally turned to the man and he said, "Sir, my friend would like to know if you love Jesus." And at that, the man's countenance fell and he looked down at his hands for a while. And then he said, "Well, you know, I'm going through some really tough times right now. And maybe I need to talk to somebody about that one." And Milton then got to talk to that man about Jesus. And that man's relationship with God was way different when they touched down in Dallas that day. What the missionary thought was a very awkward spot being caused by a little girl sitting next to him turned out to be a chance for him to pass on the best thing that he had in his life to share. Folks, we have found food. We have found treasure. We have found something that changes life. Jesus makes your world better. No matter how bad it gets, he's still good. And there are so many people living life right now under siege and hungry. Did you hear about the lady with the very light pigmentation in her hair? I don't want to say what she... Anyways, she had very light hair, and she's watching the news with her husband one night, and the newscaster said, "Tonight we have learned that 6 Brazilian men died today in a skydiving accident." And the lady with yellow hair started to cry. She started sobbing. And her husband said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "That's the worst thing I've ever heard, ever." And he was confused by her response, but he often was. And he said, "Well, yeah, that's bad, but they were skydiving and there's always a risk involved." He said, "Try to pull yourself together." And she tried, and after a minute, she kind of got control and she said, okay, but how many is a Brazilian?" There are a lot of people in trouble in our country today. And we hear about the percentage every day on the news about how many people have it and how many people don't have it. And the thing is, we're not even really talking about the it that matters most. And it shows. Because the problem isn't really the hatred in a policeman's heart. And the problem isn't really the anger of protesters who are violating curfew in cities. And the problem isn't really the desire for control amongst our politicians. And the problem isn't really the fear of the future in the homes of people who are unemployed. Really, the problem is that people are hungry. They are really hungry, and they have nothing that satisfies that hunger. Because only a relationship with Jesus can do that. The only thing that will fix, really fix what's broken in our world is people being changed from the inside out by Jesus. That's the treasure. The guys in 2 Kings 7 tested positive for leprosy, but they had found a great treasure and they shared it. Did you hear about the guy who bought stock in chicken broth and beef broth and vegetable broth, hoping someday to be a billionaire? I can't tell. Are they laughing? Do you know how rich we really are? We who know him, do you know how rich we are? So once upon a time, the whole country was in big trouble. But a few people who unexpectedly stumbled onto a great treasure decided to share what they had found, and that changed everything. May their tribe increase.